You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the internet broadcast of the Intelligent Aboriginal News Service. Find us on the web at angryindian.blogspot.com.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is the Angry Indian, and you're listening to the Angry Indian Interviews, Angry Indian Radio, blogspot.com. And we're speaking with The Stimulator, one of Canada's most, how would you define yourself to the authorities in Canada?
To the authorities in Canada?
Yeah.
I don't know how I would define myself to the authorities in Canada, but in general, I am a loudmouth anarchist who is just trying to spread revolution and make trouble.
Okay, just out of curiosity, how do you define revolution?
Oh, man. We're starting easy, I guess, huh? Revolution, to me, would be a total system change. It would not be a reform. It would not be fixing the system, but doing away with it altogether, you know, and starting fresh, starting from the bottom up, starting from the people level. And doing away with the structures of power that dominate us right now.
When you discuss these concepts with, not so much with the people who follow your work, but just with everyday people, where you live in Canada, how do they respond to your, well, not so much to your work, but actually to your opinions as an individual? I find that when I actually speak to people and I tell them what I think, I get a variety of reactions. From one extreme to the other, and what usually, gets me, and this is what I want to talk to you about, when you speak, the image that we have in the United States is that Canadians are very passive, very liberal, are pretty much open to just about anything, but then those of us who do news and who especially deal with Aboriginal issues and other bias issues in Canada, we see something different. How would you explain that?
Well, my partner, who is a writer and a researcher, was the one who told me, before I'm done with you, I'm going to make you hate Canada. And she has done a wonderful job at that, because I moved to Canada about 5 years ago from the States. And yes, I had that same impression of the litany of stuff that you told me at the beginning, open, liberal, or as John Stewart says it, our gay neighbor to the north, And, unfortunately, Canada has done an amazing job of public relations. Canada has built this image that they are for human rights, that they are progressive, and so forth and so on. The reality is that Canada is as bad as the United States and other colonial countries. And all you need to do is go back a couple hundred years and just look at the history of how the First Nations here is what we're treated. Smallpox, genocide, displacement, rape, slavery. You could just go down the list, and that treatment has not really ended. The process of genocide and extermination continues to this day. When people talk about, for instance, here in Vancouver, the poorest neighborhood in Canada, according to most people, is the downtown east side. And granted, most of the people there who are addicts and who are homeless and who are prostitutes are indigenous folks. But what nobody ever says is that, that is the poorest neighborhood outside of the reserves. If you have ever been to a reserve out here, and not all of them, right? There's some of them that have gotten rich through real estate because they own like pretty choice pieces of land in and around Vancouver. But if you go elsewhere, you see the poverty, you see the alcoholism, you see the systematic, destruction and assimilation of a people who proudly lived in these lands sustainably for 10,000 years. And so that's just the indigenous aspect. Canadian companies, Canadian mining companies are notorious for going all over the world, displacing people, murdering people, destroying their lands just to extract gold or copper or whatnot. And then finally, there's the topic of the Canadian military, who to this day is occupying Afghanistan alongside the United States and other countries, and also has done a tremendous amount of abuses in Haiti and in other parts of the world. So there's a shiny glow around Canada for, you know, their, you know, nice, supposedly nice social healthcare system and gay marriage and all these other things, which are great. You know, I'm not dissing those, but you know, the population here in Canada, just like it happens in the United States, lives in a bubble and does not really see or recognize how awful this colonial system is.
Well, just as with the lower 48, do Canadians, in your experience, view themselves as colonialists?
No, absolutely not. I think that there is a very short-sighted view of history, and even to this day, even though the Queen inhabits all government buildings in the form of a photograph, and she is called the Queen of Canada, and I'm talking about the Queen of England, and she inhabits the Canadian dollar and all the currency, even though it's just so plain that you know, at one point this was a colony of the UK, and it has done loads to colonize here and abroad. People here are ignorant of that history, or if they do, they don't see it like they don't see it as they're being colonizers. You know, somehow they feel that's just stuff that happened a long time ago, even though it continues to this day. And you know, and I mean, to make matters worse, you know, the company that, you know, was in a big part responsible for the genocide and the colonialism that happened here in Canada, the Hudson's Bay Company, now calls itself HBC and has department stores all over Canada. So that colonial history is still very present, and the symbols of it are amazingly prominent.
I mean, when we look at Afghanistan, you know, those of us who are politically aware, and who will try to be, we have the impression that the majority of Euro settler Canadians, anyway, are not particularly supportive of Canada's role in Afghanistan, in Iraq. I this question on whether or not they will be directly involved in the Yemen campaign, this new campaign. Your new documentary that you're about to go on a North American tour, which includes Mexico, for people who'd like to separate the continent. How will this address those particular issues in such a way that the average person living in North America will be able to comprehend what is happening and be able to feel that they actually do have the right to have some influence on these policies?
Well, there's a couple of things happening here, right? Like, let me just start with the idea of rights. A lot of people push, and this is sort of like a concept that's just new to me, not the concept of rights, but the concept of critiquing the whole idea of rights. Rights are something that the government or the centralized power structure hands down to you. And I really don't like this whole concept of us pleading for the state to give us rights. I think we need to take our rights. We need to say what our rights is and affirm it, and not live in this system where rights is something that we have to plead for and they have to be handed to us. Not to sound redundant, but about my film. My film it basically uses the writings of Derek Jensen, who is a North American, is a Californian writer, who has done an amazing two-volume set critiquing civilization, and really pushes the idea that civilization needs to be brought down. Now, how this addresses war, is that in doing that critique and that analysis of a civilization, I generally examine these power structures that rule us right now, and one of them is the military. And when people out there in the world, you know, oppose the war, oppose human rights violations, civil rights violations, etc., I just don't really see a lot of discourse on abolishing the military. And you know, the military is really, in a sense, what makes this whole damn thing, you know, go, this whole system, this whole civilization. Without the military, the U.S. would not be what it is today. And the same goes for Canada and the U.K. and France and Germany and whatnot. You know, this is the pinnacle of the power structure. And that analysis about how do we, you know, take out the military, it's hardly ever present in any sort of discourse when it comes to talking about social change. You know, it's, you know, we're always pleading for rights. We always want this and that. But I think, and I am convinced, that if we are going to maintain life on the planet, not just for humans, but for also our other cousins, our non-human cousins, and plant life and water life and whatnot, we need to have a total system change. And the military is part of that system, so the military has to go.
Well, when you mention that as an opinion, say, to the average person on the street in Canada, what is their general response?
Well, to be honest, one of the problems with being involved in activism is that you sort of create this this bubble around you. And most of my friends and most of the people I interact with have maybe not the exact analysis, but this general analysis that I have. And so it's just sometimes it's a little bit hard to go out there and get that opinion. I do believe, though, that people have this general understanding, even though they might not have articulated it in the same way that I did. But I think that everybody understands that the system is fucked, that we're fucked, that the planet is fucked, and that they know who the culprit is. And it's just my job, at least, I think, to try to articulate these things. Because here's the deal, right? I think all of us have these feelings deep in our gut. And every so often somebody comes along and just, you know, says it. And then you don't feel so alone. You don't feel insane. You don't feel like you are the only person in the world who feels like this. And so Derek Jensen was that for me. You know, when I saw him speak, he basically says a lot of things I'd already thought, that I already had analysis around. But, you know, I didn't really have anybody to talk about it with. So you've really posed me with a really terrific exercise. And maybe, you know, that's one of the things that I'm going to discover during my tour, is how far off the left cliff I have fallen. But to a certain degree, I don't think that I'm totally out of touch with what people feel, because a lot of people that I deal with on a day-to-day are working class people who have this analysis. So they're not like university scholars or, you know, leftist intellectuals. These are folks who, you know, came up working and through their own experience, you know, gathered these conclusions and validated them through books, films, and whatnot.
Yeah, one of the things that I got from the trailer for NCIV was that, you know, the immediate impression that, you know, that came across to me, and I think will come across to some other people, especially in the United States, is that they felt that it was too, most people I think will feel that it's too intellectual. I've heard comments about Jensen that his ideas are very unreachable for the average person, that it's hard for a lot of people to deal with his concepts, you know, in terms of the environment, in terms of a real end game if things continue, such as the BP oil spill, such as the tar sands in your neck of the woods. How can grassroots activists such as ourselves surpass this hurdle in being able to get the average person who really doesn't pay attention to news, who really wants to believe that they are completely isolated from just about everything negative that happens in civil society. You know, how do you feel the average person can be reached without them feeling that they're being preached to, that they're being told what to do by, you know, yet another faction of, you know, the political strata? You know, I would really want to emphasize that the average person out here feels, and you identified this, completely hopeless and completely isolated, whether it's from police brutality or their tax money going to support foreign occupations. You know, in your experience, what do you see as the game changer in this? Because obviously the BP oil spill, as far as environment, hasn't done anything. The fact that so many people are being wiped out by these drones doesn't seem to be doing anything, and they're stepping all of this activity up.
Well, there's a couple of things happening here, right? To answer your first question, how do we reach these folks? Well, that's exactly why I make films. It's a medium that's widely accepted. North Americans don't read, which is a fucking travesty, but you know, that's just the way it is. And that's why I'm doing mass media, and I'm doing it in a way that's extremely visual, that is extremely digestible. The film is broken down into pieces that are 10 minutes or less. So even if you don't want to watch the whole film, you can watch one part that basically explains the civilization's need for violence in order to perpetuate itself. And that's part of the reason why I do the show with a stimulator as well. It's a way to give folks like bite-sized pieces of information in a format that they understand, with the hope that once they're done watching my show, or in this case, NCIF, that they would go out there and pick up their distance books. Because the deal is this, is that very few people that I know that have actually read Endgame, both books, beginning to end. It's about 1,000 pages, and it sounds like a whole lot, but most people who have read those end up agreeing with it. And the positions that Derek takes in that book are amazingly radical. And even with that, it's just common sense. You know, you see, you all you gotta do, you know, just think about a James Bond movie, for instance. James Bond's tied to like a machine that's bringing him close to this laser that's gonna chop him in half. He knows what he has to do. He has to destroy that machine or get the hell out of the way. But if he doesn't destroy that machine's gonna continue and is gonna destroy something else, right? So we know what's causing this destruction. It's actually pretty simple. You know, you see a coal-fired power plant is dumping tons of carbon to the atmosphere. It's producing CO2 that's going to exacerbate the global warming situation. What do you need to do? You stop that power plant. You know, I mean, I know it sounds terrible and extreme, but that's what you do. That is basically the end right there. And that's basically what, along with his nuanced critique of civilization and all the different aspects with it, that's basically what's being said in his books. And his books are amazingly easy to read. And they're rich, and they have humor in it, and they're just really, they're just, a lot of people have tried to say what he has, what Derek is saying, because what he's saying is nothing new, it's just that he said it best. So again, my ultimate goal is for people to watch this film, and if you agree with content, hopefully pick up one of Derek's books, and you know, go a little bit further, and get a deeper, nuanced opinion. But I forgot what my second point was.
It's okay. Yeah, I'll just ask you one last question. We saw a hell of a lot of, as far as North America goes, and perhaps even for Canada, during the Olympics 2010 games, you were extremely active in reporting what was happening on the street, what was happening to activists, the police brutality, how folks were being cordoned off, and of course the Black Bloc as they went through downtown and made their opinions heard, seen, and felt. There was a massive, massive protest in the UK recently. We're seeing uprisings in the Western Sahara. You know, we're seeing people stand up pretty much everywhere except the United States. And as someone who does not live in the United States any longer, what is your take on the passivity that we're seeing here with the, you know, the working class, and, you know, this general people, you know, indigenous people here, you know, they try to stand up. You have individuals, you have small groups, but there is no mass movement worth anything in the United States. Whereas in Canada, you know, I mean, we can look at the Oka crisis, but we can also look at, you know, Gustafson Lake and you know, various things that have happened. Mohawk Nation News has been extremely good at keeping up with these issues. And, you know, as someone who's not living, but right next door, you know, Americans have a hell of a lot to say about Canada, but as a Canadian, what do you have to say about the lack of a movement in the United States?
Well, a couple of things. I don't really agree that there's not people resisting. For instance, recently we saw the verdict of Oscar Grant's murderer in Oakland, California, and he got some sort of involuntary manslaughter, some sort of bullshit, you know, slap in the wrist. Well, he'll spend like a very minimal amount of time in jail, probably get out, you know, and half the time on parole, and people actually took to the street. And, you know, in the end, like, the folks who resisted there are the folks who are most vulnerable to police repression, you know, mostly Black folks. Same thing in L.A. A Honduran man was murdered by the pigs, and people even more vulnerable, undocumented folks,
exactly,
actually took to the streets and let their voices heard. Furthermore, the pro-immigration movement in 2006 saw the largest mobilization in U.S. history, larger than anything that the civil rights movement achieved. You know, we saw like 2 million people in New York City, 2 million people in Chicago, 4 million people in L.A. Then smaller cities saw like hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, I think that the potential is there, right? I think that, but in the end, it's going to be those are the people who are the most affected, who feel the pain of the system on their daily lives, are the ones who are going to lead the way, because unfortunately, white working class America has been co-opted by the fake Tea Party movement. It's been proven that it's a totally corporate funded movement. It's a very dangerous situation with that, because they're using platforms of hate, xenophobia, and pro-gun, which, you know, I should say I'm not anti-gun, but you have a pretty volatile mix of things there that are being promoted by extremely right-wing billionaires, and that is what has captured a chunk of working-class America. Not all of it, by the way. The Tea Party, by far, is not the majority of working-class America, but it's certainly a force to be reckoned with. Now, with that said, yes, this is one of the reasons why I am constantly reporting on resistance movements around the world and broadcasting it to a Canadian and American audience, so they see how other people are doing it, and they see how other people are not afraid, and they see, and then hopefully they get inspired by what's happening, you know, elsewhere. The United States is the big prize. It's the one to take, right? And so, and I, you know, not to toot my own horn, but this is exactly why I do what I do, because I want to inspire folks to take action. And this doesn't necessarily mean that people should take militant action all the time, but there's a very huge number of ways in which people can get involved and essentially build infrastructure for a resistance movement to flourish.
About, at least I hope. Our guest has been the Stimulator, Canadian free speech activist and documentary filmmaker. He is about to embark on a continent-wide tour of North America to promote his newest project, NCIV, Resist or Die. His work can be seen and heard at submedia.tv and other media outlets made available on what is left of the free internet. This has been The Angry Indian. You've been listening to The Angry Indian interviews, and we'd like to thank the Stimulator fan for taking the time to sit with us.
Thanks for having me.
Alright, thank you.
Angry Indian Rap, you are listening to the Angry Indian Non-Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Talk radio for the fourth world.
When the Creator gave us this land to live on, there was no white man on this island. For he was across the ocean. Not for his papers, not here in this land.
Habla real para los pueblos originales. Está escuchando usted Radio Andino.
On est parlé pendant des peuples originaires. Vous écoutez Radio Andino. Andino Radio.blogspot.com.
AngryIndianRadio.blogspot.com.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio. AngryIndianRadio.blogspot.com.
So this is Troy Anthony Davis, and I've been sitting on Georgia's death row for 16 years for a crime I did not commit. It's been a struggle for me and my family, as well as the victim's family, who I sympathize with barely, simply because they have been cheated out of justice just as I have. They deserve justice more than anyone deserves justice. Because of Amnesty's assistance, as well as Arnold and Porter, you know, I'm still sitting here alive today, being able to have conversation. And I want to thank all Amnesty's supporters, you know, all the volunteer workers. I want to thank everyone all over the world, you know, who has been praying for me, supporting me, writing letters and signing petitions and things like that. I want to encourage people to continue to sign the Amnesty petitions and continue to write letters and look into my situation, because this situation could have happened to anyone, but it needs to start with me. It needs to continue to let their voice be heard, because if their voice had not been heard thus far, the parole board probably would have went ahead and let me be executed. You know, my faith in God all these years has kept me strong, because in any other situation, had I not had God in my life and a strong family support base, you know, I would have been given up. You know, out of, you know, there's a couple of guys back here that are dropping their appeals and saying, you know, they'd rather go ahead and be executed than spend the rest of their life in prison. And with me, because I have faith that God will eventually intervene and set things right, you know, it kept me strong. It gave me hope. You should never be able to convict a man or even indict a person, man or woman, without any physical evidence, none whatsoever. I will never take another human being's life. And this killer is still out there. My family's in mourning. The victim's family's in mourning. And the truth is still locked in because I didn't get justice. But in DNA cases, you know, that's physical evidence that you can test. I have no physical evidence to test to prove my innocence. But when these witnesses volunteered to come forth because their conscience was bothering them about the lies that they told on me, when they came forth and signed these affidavits, then that was evidence for me to test. When they took me to that death cell for death watch 24 hours before the execution, you know, it really affected me and everybody on death row, because you had grown men crying because they've heard about my situation. They know I'm innocent. They was like, they said, if I couldn't get no justice, nobody could get justice.